From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When an election is close, as the race between President Obama and Governor Romney appears to be, the what-if questions often come up. The scenario you most hear is, what if one man wins the popular vote and the other comes out on top in the Electoral College? It's happened before, of course, because, as you know, there are two parts to electing a president in this country, and the part that matters isn't the popular vote part. But how did we get an Electoral College? How was it supposed to work? Whose interests was it supposed to protect? Today in the program, we're talking about the Electoral College and getting to some of those questions. We're also asking, do we still need the Electoral College in a modern era? What effect has it had on the American political process? What happens if we ditch it? We invite you to join us today with your own questions about the Electoral College after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The what-if questions are popping up as we head into the election day. What if one man wins the popular vote and one man wins the Electoral College? Well, here's what happens. The one who wins the Electoral College becomes president. It's just how it works in this country. And you would think these kinds of cases are rare, but they're not really. Democrats are still smarting, of course, from the 2000 election where that scenario, in fact, played out. The scholar Alexander Kasar points out there have been four times like the year 2000. There have been six times in the country's history where a switch of less than 10,000 votes would have given the presidency to the man who came in second in the popular vote. In 2004, Kasar says, George W. Bush won the popular vote by 3.5 million votes. But if John Kerry would have gotten just 60,000 more votes in Ohio, he would have been president. Today in the program, we're trying to make sense of the Electoral College. We're talking about its history, how it came about. We're also talking about how it works, what happens if there's a tie, for example. Not completely out of the realm of possibility, by the way. We'll also explore the possibility of getting rid of the college. Turns out that's easier said than done. And not everyone thinks it should be done, in fact, that the system actually protects broader interests in smaller states. We invite you to join us today with your own comments or questions about the Electoral College. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let me introduce Alexander Kasar to the program. He's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard University. His book, The Right to Vote, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and he's joining us today from the studios there at Harvard. Professor Kasar, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me onto the show.
So I wanted to start with some history. How did we come to have the Electoral College? Let's start with the fact, as you've written, that the Founding Fathers had quite a lot of difficulty deciding how a president should be chosen in the first place.
They did. They were they didn't have any clear models about what to do, and there was a lot of uncertainty. And if you look at the records of the Constitutional Convention, they kept going back and forth. One option was to have the executive chosen by Congress. A lot of people wanted that. Others feared that it would make the president dependent on Congress and currying favor with Congress. Another option was to have an actual national vote. And there was reluctance on this on several grounds. Some people actually distrusted the people. There was also a concern that in a dispersed rural country, most people would not really know who the candidates were and thus might not vote wisely or in an informed way. And what they finally came up with at the end was this idea of an electoral college, which if you think about it, looks something like in its design, where it's an indirect election, people vote for electors who then choose or who then cast votes for the president. It looks a little bit like a temporary Congress convened for one purpose only, which is to choose the president, and then it disbands.
So it seems like, and this is something you've kind of written about, it seemed like this idea was the least bad of all the other options, the least objectionable.
I think that's precisely right, and a very good way to characterize it. They weren't sure that this was a good thing. It seemed to avoid the defects of the other options. And so they decided to go with this. And within a very short period of time, indeed, many of them thought that there were flaws in the design. One flaw was evident right away, which is that they didn't provide for any way to distinguish between votes for president and votes for vice president, and they had to fix that a little while later. But I don't think – although there's a famous quote, I think, from Hamilton talking about what a great idea this was, I don't think most of the founding fathers really thought this was their best piece of work.
You've written this. You wrote that the Electoral College was a rough compromise among tired men who needed to bring their work to a close and who knew that George Washington was going to be the first president anyway.
No, I think it's very important that we humanize the founding fathers. I mean, they were quite brilliant and quite remarkable in what they did, but they were people who had spent the entire summer in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It was hot. They were tired. They had never expected to be there that long. Various people went off and took breaks and left things to committees, and they felt like it was getting to the end of the summer, and they felt like they had to come up with something.
I guess the question often comes up, how much the founding fathers really trusted the rank and file to make decisions like that, to play a part in an electoral process?
It's a very good question, and I don't think that there's one answer for all of the founders.
Yeah.
Someone, for example, like Benjamin Franklin, the oldest of the founders, who was carried to the Constitutional Convention each day in a chair, probably did trust the people a lot. He had some very deep democratic convictions, and he thought that they could be trusted. Others were much more wary. They were uncertain for one thing, and disagreed among themselves about who should have the right to vote in the first place.
Yeah.
And they had a concern from reading the things they read about the English Constitution and the history of England, the history of Rome. They had a concern that too much popular participation would lead to demagoguery and dictatorship.
I wanted to ask, the Electoral College was never intended as a – or maybe it was. It seems like it wasn't really intended as a deliberative body. I think you've said it was seen as more a kind of a messenger system.
No, I think that what the founding fathers envisioned was something that was more deliberative, that the electors in each state would deliberate, not the entire national body, but within each state people would get together, they would think about it, they would talk about it. I think they did imagine that. It never functioned that way. It never functioned that way. From the beginning, it became a messenger system, in some cases manipulated by state legislatures.
How did slavery play into the deliberations? I guess the question was, how do you count slave populations in these states?
Slavery was, of course, perhaps the most vexed issue at the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah.
And slavery plays a role in the Electoral College in that its design was intended to reinforce and perhaps further the compromise over slavery and representation that had already been made with respect to Congress and the apportionment of seats. And what that was the famous or infamous three-fifths clause.
Mm-hmm.
It was a compromise between the North and the South, and what it said was that slaves – for the purposes of representation, that's to say for the purposes of determining how many seats each state got in Congress, slaves were counted as three-fifths of a person. Mm-hmm. So the population of Virginia would be its white free population and 60% of its slaves. That gave Virginia much more political influence than it would have had if only the white population counted for representation. What the Electoral College does, because the number of seats that a state gets is the sum of its seats in the House of Representatives and two for the Senate, it gives that same added weight in the Electoral College, even though, of course, slaves are not voting. And moving ahead in the history, this is a part of the history which I think we tend to ignore. If you move ahead in the history after the Civil War, after the abolition of slavery, and particularly by the end of the 19th century, when free African Americans are disfranchised throughout the South, what you get is really something that looks like the Five-Fifths Clause, which is that African Americans count towards representation, they count towards electoral votes, but they do not vote. And what that means, in effect, is that the South, which is discriminating contrary to the Constitution, is gaining much more political weight and political influence than it would have had there been a national popular election.
You've talked about the problem, the fact that it – no one really thought that much or considered the possibility, or at least the practical possibility, of getting rid of the Electoral College until after civil rights, I guess, because the South was always – objecting. That was the major obstacle, I suppose, over the years?
The South was the major obstacle towards having a national popular vote, having that kind of reform.
Yeah.
What one sees in the records going back to – I have found it as early as a remarkable Senate debate in 1816 – is they're talking about various ways to try to fix the system, and someone says, why don't we just have the people vote? And, you know, about a half hour later, somebody else says, well, what will that do to, you know, in the South, which has its population of a special character? Mm-hmm. What happens is that the perceived and real Southern opposition to moving to a national popular vote makes that idea pretty much a non-starter for the 19th century and well into the 20th century. And what that does in turn is that it shifts the energies of reform. And there was a lot of energy for reform. There were a lot of proposals to get rid of the Electoral College. There was hundreds and hundreds of them, but they tended to focus on getting rid of the winner take all system, and maybe getting rid of the human electors themselves.
I guess this is a very basic question, but how does it work exactly? I guess every state is given one electoral vote for each of its senators as well as for each of its members in the House of Representatives.
That's correct.
Yeah. And I guess the question is, what's the problem with that? And one of the things you've talked about is it means, among other things, that votes cast by people living in small states will count for more than the votes of those living in large states.
That's exactly right. I mean, the number of seats in Congress in the House of Representatives obviously is directly proportional to the population.
Yeah.
But it's the add-on of that extra two, which may not seem like a very big deal, but if you add an extra two electoral votes to I think the 27 that New York has or the 50-odd that California has, that's not greatly increasing the percentage. If you add it to the one that Vermont has and I think North Dakota, you're really tripling its electoral votes. So that the way it turns out, if you think in terms of number of electoral votes per capita, per population, there are very, very significant differentials. I mean, going from something like one electoral vote per every 250,000 person to 600,000 people.
Yeah. Well, Wyoming, for example, one electoral vote for every 170,000 residents. California has one for every about 600,000 residents.
Right. Right. I'm glad you have the exact numbers. I don't have them in front of me.
Yeah. Well, we got them from you.
Okay.
Another flaw which you've written about is that the fast-growing states are always underrepresented in the Electoral College because it's only adjusted every 10 years during the census, the population numbers.
That's right. That is another problem. It's more of a problem in some places and sometimes than others. I mean, the core problem is that it's a mechanism which does not really conform to the principle of one person, one vote. And that is a principle that I and frankly I think most Americans think is at the heart of of democracy and of democratic procedures.
I wanted to ask you about a few near misses, because you've written about the fact that you think that near misses would be rare, but it turns out that they aren't. There are a lot of circumstances. I was mentioning some at the top of the program. Four times when the man who lost the popular vote became president. And some of these stories are kind of gripping. I wanted you to talk about 1876, when one electoral vote separated the Republican, who was Rutherford B. Hayes, and the Democrat, Samuel Tilden. And that contest, which is interesting, I think, this story, because it seems so parallel in some ways to what is happening in the contest, the presidential contest this year. I mean, this in 1876 comes in the wake of a financial crisis 3 years earlier. Of course, the Civil War just a decade before. Talk about the atmosphere of the presidential race that year, 1876.
Well, the atmosphere. I think unfortunately you're right about many of the parallels, which is a potentially alarming thought, but. You know, the atmosphere was pretty acrid in the 1870s, the party atmosphere. I mean, it's not only that the Civil War had been over for a decade, a little bit more, but the process of Reconstruction in the South had been dragging on. There were still Union troops in the South. White Southerners were resisting the more democratic regimes that had been forced upon them, regimes that included many African-American elected officials and African-American voters. And it looked like a stalemate that people were tired of. Meanwhile, the country, as you mentioned, it was in the middle. It hadn't come to an end. It was in the middle of what I think still remains the longest continuous downturn in the economy that we ever experienced from 1873 to 1878. The Great Depression is a little different because things bob up a little bit in the middle of the 30s. But times are not good, and the two parties have very little love for one another. The Democratic Party, which has a strong and growing base in the South as Southern states are readmitted to the unions. They see the Republicans as oppressors. The Republicans see the Democrats, not all Democrats, but many Democrats as having helped to cause the Civil War. It's a tough climate. Mm. And you're quite right that the election comes down to, I mean, Tilden gets, I forget the exact number, but he gets a number of electoral votes. He needs one more. And there are many that are disputed. And part of the potential parallel, let us hope that this turns out to be simply a flight of fancy on the part of our historical imaginations.
Right.
But the issue becomes whether the state counts in several states that are reported to Congress are legitimate. In other words, you have reported totals which would actually give enough votes to Tilden to make him president, but they are challenged as having been the result of either fraud or really of what we would today call voter suppression of African American votes. And then that raises in turn a procedural question of who it is in Congress that gets to determine whether which rosters of votes or whether a state's reported popular vote and electoral vote tally is legitimate. It was an issue that had never arisen before.
Mm. Man, federal troops stationed to guard polls. There were fraud reported from both camps. I guess there was a shot even fired at Rutherford B. Hayes.
Yes, or certainly in his vicinity.
Yeah.
This was, let's remember Lincoln had been assassinated, a decade earlier. And in fact, there would be another president assassinated 5 years later. This is a very, very tough, contentious time. You know, we... It also, in terms of guns and elections. The people who were there had lived through the 1850s when in states like Kansas, elections had often been contested by and to some degree settled by bands of scores and hundreds of men riding around the countryside with guns, frightening and intimidating people who might be thinking of voting the wrong way.
What effect do you think the Electoral College has on the political process, not just historically? What effect do you figure it has today on the process? What footprint are you seeing on the process today?
Well, let me do a brief backup here, because when we're talking about one of the things which happens when we talk about the Electoral College is that the Electoral College has a number of distinctive features, some of which are built in, some of which are not necessarily built in.
Yeah.
And the feature which I think is having the greatest impact today has to do with the decisions that we've made, or the mechanism through which electoral votes are allocated, which is to say almost all states do it as winner take all. If you win the state's popular vote, then you get all of its electoral votes.
Yeah.
That is not in the Constitution. It seems reasonably evident that that was not what the founders intended. They thought that electoral votes should probably be done in some proportional or district basis within the state. But we have winner-take-all, and winner-take-all has been dominant almost everywhere. I guess Maine and Nebraska now do use some kind of district system. And I think that what the winner-take-all system does is to really significantly deform what presidential elections look like. I look at the last couple of weeks of this presidential campaign as Exhibit A. There is no presidential election here in Massachusetts. We get an occasional sense that one is going on because New Hampshire is a nearby neighbor in New Hampshire.
Right.
And New Hampshire is a swing state, and there's occasionally an ad aimed at New Hampshire voters that happens to show up on our television stations. I imagine your situation looks somewhat similar.
Yeah.
This has been an election campaign which almost from the beginning has been fought in about 9 or 10 states. And everything is tailored to the electorate in the 9 or 10 states. There's no popular mobilization or engagement elsewhere. That doesn't seem to me like the healthiest way to educate people about democracy or to mobilize people for critical decisions.
Alexander Kasar is with us. He teaches history and social policy at Harvard. He's the author of the book, The Right to Vote. When we get a little bit later in the program, he's going to join us again, where we start talking about efforts to change it, to what happens if the system itself goes away. We're also going to hear, and after we get back from a break, the case for the Electoral College. So we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST, our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are trying to answer some of the questions you may have about the Electoral College. You've seen the opinion polls that have President Obama and Governor Romney at a virtual dead heat among likely voters. But, of course, it's not the popular vote that decides the presidency. Just where did we get this Electoral College? What was the idea behind it? How does it work? And what happens if you get rid of it? 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is Tara Ross. She's a retired lawyer and the former editor-in-chief of the Texas Review of Law and Politics. She's the author of Enlightened Democracy. The second edition of that book came out just last month. She's joining us today from a studio in Dallas, Texas. And Tara Ross, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with the framers of the Constitution, because here it seems you have a very different impression of how the founders saw the Electoral College from our guest Alexander Kasar earlier. Because Kasar says the Electoral College wasn't an idea that the founders were terribly excited about. It turned out to be the least objectionable of the ideas for electing the presidency. But you don't see it that way. You say that they actually thought the Electoral College was quite an achievement.
Yeah, I would paint a different picture. They were quite proud of their creation, I think. He'd mentioned Alexander Hamilton, and Alexander Hamilton, in that quote, he's not only saying that he thought the Electoral College was, he said, quote, if it's not perfect, at least it's excellent. He was also commenting on the lack of dispute about the system at the state ratification debates. And there was very little dispute. The founders spent a lot of time crafting their system. You know, I would not describe it as tired old men who just wanted to go home. I would say, no, they spent the whole summer on this. They discussed it over and over again because they knew how important it was to get it right. They had just fought a whole revolution because of the tyranny that they felt they had been under because of the British king and the British Parliament. They were not very likely just to brush it off and say, oh, well, we're sure it's going to work out. You know, George Washington's going to do it for us. They knew that they needed to establish something that would work better than what they had been under. And it was very important to them. They had given their lives. Some of their family members had given their lives. They had risked their lives. And they were going to achieve something better. And I think that they felt that they had done a very good job.
You write about the fact that the founders were confronting these two contradictory goals. First, how you allow people to, you know, to make a call for president, but still protect the minority from the majority. And it seems as though you're saying that this is kind of the, you know, the critical concept behind the structuring of American democracy itself. You create this federalist system where majorities rule, but minorities have an opportunity to get their voices heard. And you say that's what's coming into play here, I guess, with the Electoral College.
Well, exactly. Sometimes the Electoral College gets bashed and people say, oh, the founders, they did not trust the people. I would say the founders did not trust the people or government. They didn't trust either side. And they had to figure out what to do. They wanted to be self-governing. As I said, they had just fought a whole revolution about that. They were not likely to give it up. They missed their representation in Parliament. They were fighting for that. On the other hand, they didn't trust government either. They thought power corrupts and you need checks and balances in government. So what do? You can't create a pure democracy. In a pure democracy, 51% rules the other 49% all the time, no matter how unreasonable the 51% is. You know, the example I often give is in the wake of 9/11 and fear, anger, outrage, bigotry, whatever, 51% can do anything to the rest of the country. The founders wanted something better. They wanted something different. And so they created a government that would combine several different forms of governments. They would have there are democratic aspects in our Constitution. That's great. There are also Republican, small r, deliberation, compromise should be encouraged among elected officials. Federalism, the ability of states to act as states or to act on behalf of their own state's interest, they put all of these checks and balances in our Constitution, including the Electoral College, because they wanted to be self-governing, but they also wanted to protect political minorities, most importantly, the small states.
Explain how minority interests are protected by the Electoral College in the 21st century.
Well, look, this maybe the best way to look at it is I think I heard you guys talking about Wyoming earlier.
Yeah.
If you look at a state like California, it's got, if I remember correctly, 37, 38 million people. You've got Wyoming with 500,000 people. California has 66 times as many people as Wyoming. OK, but now if you take a look at their electors, OK, they have 55 electors compared to Wyoming's 3. That's 18 times the number of electors. Now, you know, Wyoming is not ruling California in either of these situations, but you've kind of blunted the impact a little bit. Wyoming has more of a voice than they would have otherwise. California, it is harder for California to trample a small state like Wyoming. And I think that's what we're going for. You know, we do not need Wyoming and Rhode Island to rule the whole country. Nobody is trying for that. But we are trying to give small states just enough leverage so that if they are being tyrannized, they can do something about it.
You've written that under the current system, presidential candidates, you say, cannot succeed if they focus too narrowly on a handful of states or regions. But some people say that's exactly what you're seeing right now. You're seeing this focus on the swing states right now. North Dakota, South Dakota, Utah. I could go down a list. Mm-hmm. They're getting no attention whatsoever from presidential candidates. What do you make of that?
I look at it differently. First, swing states change all the time. Virginia, North Carolina, these are new swing states. New Hampshire, by the way, fantastic that a state with four electoral votes is a swing state. That's really great. But swing states and safe states are constantly changing. I'm from Texas. We even used to vote Democrat. California used to vote Republican. I could go down a whole list of examples along these lines. But the second thing I would say is, look, the election is not only about the campaign commercials that are running in Ohio and New Hampshire right now. The election is about 4 years of governance. It's about what states thought of the 4 years of decisions made by elected officials. Texas is safe for a reason. Texas is safe because it didn't like the health care bill. You know, it didn't like the environmental decisions made by this administration. California is just the opposite. Now, these are safe states are not being ignored. They are not unimportant. They have simply already made up their minds. And if they change their minds, if they start to feel ignored by one or the other political parties, believe me, they will make their opinion known very fast. As an example, West Virginia, I think, was being ignored by the Democratic Party in the 90s. And the Republicans took advantage of that. They went in there and they pointed out to West Virginia, do you see how these environmental policies of the Democratic Party are harming industries in your state? And West Virginians, who were, I think, again, being ignored by the Democratic Party, stood up, paid attention, and started voting Republican ever since. You cannot ignore a safe state in this country for very long without feeling the ramifications at the polls.
You've talked about the fact that you can't just change the Electoral College and not expect to really transform other elements of the country's political system. And you've said that you believe if we eliminated the Electoral College, that the current two-party system, for example, would really suffer, would really be undermined.
Yes, in that you're alluding to a quote from JFK. He basically compared our political system to a solar system of government power. And if you change one aspect of that solar system, it will have a domino effect. You can't expect to leave everything else just like it was. Basically, if you change the gravitational pull of the sun, you will pull the Earth out of orbit. You will change the Earth's atmosphere. You might make it uninhabitable. You just don't know what will happen. And in the same way, if you pull the Electoral College out of our political system, there will be all sorts of unintended ramifications. I do think that undermining the two-party system is one of those ramifications. There are others. Sometimes that makes people want to cheer to think, oh, I could go vote for a third party now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I will confess, I vote third party more often than people probably think if they've read my book. But look, the great thing about a strong two-party system such as our own is that it diminishes the influence of extremist third-party candidates that none of us want to be ruling the country. Okay, the George Wallaces of the world in 1968, when he tried to force a House contingent election, he couldn't do it. It squashes the efforts of extremist third parties in that way. Now, by contrast, more powerful, more reasonable third-party groups, think Ross Perot in 1992, those candidates do influence our politics. And I think it's great because sometimes, you know, the two parties need to be pulled back into line. They're not really doing as good a job as they should do of reaching out to everybody. In 1992, Ross Perot's fiscal concerns were, some people thought that maybe he took the election away from George H.W. Bush. And, you know, the Democrats, I think, were a little bit worried about those voters, too. In the 1994 election, both political parties knew that they wanted that 18.9% of voters who had gone to Ross Perot, and they both had plans in their platform for the fiscal responsibility issues that Ross Perot was so concerned about. And I think it is really great that Perot had such a big impact on our political system.
You've written about the fact that the Electoral College, one of the things anyway, and I found this really interesting, is remove a kind of sense of uncertainty in elections where the popular vote is really close.
Yeah.
it magnifies the margin of victory. Talk about that. That's an interesting idea.
Well, it's part of why, you know, I mean, I'm always happy to talk about anything about the Electoral College usually, but I'm not really expecting a tie or a crisis tomorrow. I'm actually kind of expecting the Electoral College will just deliver us a more certain winner. And it's just because of that history and that impact, I guess, that it normally has, which is that the Electoral College, because of the winner-take-all system, does tend to inflate the margin of victory and to give a more certain outcome. And, you know, in 1992, again, when Clinton and Bush and Perot were all in the same race, I forget the exact number, but Clinton actually won a pretty good margin in the Electoral College. And I think that was good for the country because, you know, it brings us together and it generates this feeling of, okay, we have all settled on a candidate. This is the person who did the best job of building a national coalition. He is the best representative for America right now. I think the other good effect is just that it gives us certainty. In times of war, especially, it's good to know who your commander-in-chief is. It is not good to be in uncertainty and lawsuits and stuff like we were in 2000. But 2000 is very rare in our system, and it was just an extremely rare situation.
Let me ask you this finally. It seems to, for some, it kind of comes down to this question of whether or not the Electoral College is violating a basic concept of equality, political equality. How do you respond to that question?
I think that behind the question, there is an assumption that the only way to be equal is to do the votes by individuals. But I would say, look, there's lots of ways you can do a vote, and doing votes by states is just as valid. We have a system that combines democracy and federalism. So it's not a question of – it's not like some people say the Electoral College is anti-democratic. Not true. The Electoral College combines democracy and federalism, okay? It is not purely democratic, but we have a two-part election system. In the first phase of our election, we have 51 purely democratic elections, 50 states plus D.C. Each one conducts a purely democratic election. In my state, Texas, our election, we are deciding who those 38 electors will be that will represent Texas. Every state does something similar. Now, we take the results of those 51 purely democratic elections and we conduct a second phase of the election, a federalist phase. This is the election among the states. Now, and it takes, of course, a majority of electors in that electoral vote to win the presidency. The reason we do that is because we had certain goals that we were trying to achieve in our system, and that is to make sure that presidential candidates have to appeal to as many of us as possible. They have to build national coalitions that cross regions. They have to get some big states, some small states. They have to get a whole bunch of different kinds of people to get behind them and to support them before they can win the presidency. Now, if we were to do a purely democratic election only, no federalism, just a direct vote of individuals, well, then presidential candidates could go anywhere to get those individuals. They could go only to a handful of big urban areas and rack up as many votes as they can, and that would get the White House for them. Now, I would say that's not a good system because it means that large portions of the country, you know, especially the less sparsely populated parts of the country, are going to be left out in the cold.
That's Tara Ross. She's the author of the book Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College. Joined us today from a studio in Dallas. Tara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Electoral College, and we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us back on the program, Alexander Kasar, professor of history and social policy at Harvard University, joining us from the studios there at Harvard. And Alexander Kasar, I wanted to get you to respond to some of the things. We don't need to go down point by point and respond to what Tara Ross had to say. One thing that was interesting, though, is she talked about the what she saw as the unintended consequences if you did away with the Electoral College. One thing would be less moderation, she says. You know, you would undermine the two-party system. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's quite right that there would be consequences that we don't completely foresee, and there were some that we would foresee. I think that that getting rid of the Electoral College might open things up to third parties, although in a way differently than she imagines. What the current system does is to make it very difficult for third-party candidates to have much influence nationally unless they are regionally based candidates. The example of Wallace is actually a good one, and the threat of Wallace provoked Congress to almost get rid of the Electoral College. A regionally based third-party candidate can do well. But my own view is that I'm not sure the two-party system has served us extremely well. We're the only country in the world where no new political party ever came to power in the 20th century. And I think that that having more parties in the mix can be a way of injecting different kinds of ideas. So I think that that would be a development that I would not worry about. I think that one area where we would have very unintended consequences, and I don't quite know what it would look like, would be exactly the ways in which it would shift the campaigning for president, for example. I think it might put more of a premium on grassroots people-to-people mobilization and less on television advertising, but that's very hard to predict. There are a couple of other points. I don't want to go through point by point, but
go ahead.
I do want to say two things in response to Tara's points, which, you know, I mean, I know what Tara thinks. She knows what I think. But one is that it seems to me that she was saying, oh, the founding father spent a long time thinking about this and very careful about it. But the dimension of the Electoral College that she most adamantly was defending is the winner-take-all mechanism, and that is absolutely not part of their design. And both Jefferson and later in the 1820s, Madison repudiated that. So I'm not sure that you can say, well, they thought about this, they were so careful. But in fact, that critical dimension of the Electoral College was not what they had in mind. The other thing, in terms of defending the interests of the small state, it seems to me, of small states, and I'm not sure that small states have distinct interests, but whether they do or not, those interests are certainly much more strongly and carefully protected by the existence of the Senate than by the Electoral College.
I want to get to another guest here to continue the conversation too. But before, I wanted to get your response to her idea, which I found compelling, that the Electoral College simply gives a sense of certainty in close elections. That while it was close in the electoral, it wasn't so close. While it was close in the popular vote, it wasn't so close in the Electoral College. So there's more of a mandate or something. What do you make of that?
You know, it's an argument which has been made a number of times before about the way in which the Electoral College can magnify a difference. I mean, even, say, in the case of President Obama in 2008. I'm not sure that's so true in the sense that I don't think we know that that's what people think about in the wake of an election. I would hazard the guess that if you asked people what the Electoral College margin of victory was in recent presidential elections, that 90% of the population would not know, and that a higher percentage would have some idea how close the popular vote was or was not.
Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. Aaron Blake is joining us now. He's a political blogger with The Fix at The Washington Post, joining us from their studio in Washington, D.C. And Aaron Blake, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with, that question of a tie, the big what if. You wrote a couple of weeks ago, it's pretty much unlikely, but how are you seeing that now?
You know, I still think it's very, very unlikely. I think the New York Times over the weekend did projections based on the swing states that we're looking at right now. There were 512 scenarios, and I think only 5 or 10 of them wound up being a 269-vote tie. So it's very unlikely, just given the way we see some of the swing states tilting right now. I would say that the most likely scenario under which this could potentially happen would be Obama winning in New Hampshire, Ohio, and Wisconsin, mostly because Ohio and Wisconsin are swingish states that he's seen as likely to win, and it's very hard to make another scenario under which Obama wins Ohio, as many people expect him to, and there is still an Electoral College tie.
Mm. There have been some columns by your colleagues, as a matter of fact. Ezra Klein among them. Karen Tumulty talking about a popular vote Electoral College split. What's your take on that at this stage in the race now?
I think that's much more likely than an Electoral College tie. Yeah. We are in a country right now where the two parties are becoming significantly more regional than they have been in a long time. So what that's meant is that Republicans are banking a lot of votes when it comes to the national popular vote in the South. We're going to have states like Oklahoma and in Mississippi and Alabama voting 60, 65, maybe even more percent Republican, whereas I think it's going to be difficult for President Obama to rack up those kinds of margins in the states that he's definitely going to win, like California, New York, the bluer states like that. So I think what the effect of it has been is that Republicans win the votes by larger margins in the states that they do win. And so while a majority of the country may be voting Republican, a majority of the crucial states are still tilting slightly Democratic. And so I think it's entirely possible that we could be seeing a split between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote, just like we had in 2000, lest we forget.
Yeah.
Although I will say that some of the national polling, which had shown Romney with a popular vote lead, has now shown the race basically too close to call.
Do you hear much when you're out reporting? Do people express this as a concern, the Electoral College, how unfair it is or how undemocratic it might seem or how great it is? I mean, do you hear much at all about the Electoral College?
I think this is something that people generally will focus on once it becomes an issue. Obviously, we just mentioned 2000 when there was the split between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. If that were to happen again, the second election in four elections, I think we may see more of a movement formed to deal with it. But the situation we had in 2000 was a very contentious one, and it wasn't enough to move the ball enough to really get some kind of an Electoral College change in motion. I'm not sure that, just practically speaking, it would be very easy for a change to be made, constitutional amendment, that kind of thing. It's just very difficult to get the whole country behind some kind of an electoral reform movement and basically get people interested in something like that. Mm. People may not like that the popular vote winner is different from the Electoral College winner, but half the people will be just quite fine with that result, and those half people will be good enough to keep the Electoral College in operation.
Professor Kaser, what happens if there is, let's say there's a tie? What's the mechanism that comes into play?
The mechanism is that the decision will be made by the House of Representatives voting in an unusual way. The House votes, but not with each representative getting one vote, but with each state getting one vote. So the question will become which party will control a majority of the state delegations to the House of Representatives. And barring something extremely unforeseen, that means that there will be a majority of Republican delegations and Mitt Romney would become president.
I think if I could just jump in on
Please,
that, we ran the numbers and it's actually, as it stands right now, Republicans have the majorities of 33 state delegations, while Democrats have 16. So in order for that to change, it would require a huge wave election, basically, that would render the idea of a tie pretty much inoperable. You know, if we're talking an election where Obama would have won 350 or 400 electoral votes for that big of a shift to happen in the House. Now, beyond that, though, there's also the idea that perhaps the state delegations wouldn't necessarily vote along partisan lines, but rather that some of them could be convinced to vote for the person that their state voted for, in which case it would be more complex and more difficult to predict. Given the state of affairs in Washington, D.C. right now, of course, I wouldn't expect people to necessarily put their state's popular vote ahead of their own partisan political careers.
Yeah. Professor Kaser, let's say Mitt Romney wins the popular vote but loses in the Electoral College. Do you think that would spark reform efforts? And who's been holding back reform efforts, do you think? You mentioned the South had earlier. Is one particular group holding efforts back now?
Well, I mean, certainly for a long period in our history, the South was the obstacle to having a national popular vote, not necessarily to all other reforms, but to having a national popular vote.
Yeah.
In recent years, in recent decades, there has been a partisan a generally partisan tilt on the issue of Electoral College reform, which is that Democrats have favored it and Republicans have opposed it. If, for example, with the there is this movement called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which has been going on for several years, and which is it's an attempt to build support or to achieve Electoral College reform by getting states to sign onto a compact in which they basically are saying that they will cast all of their state's electoral votes for the person who wins the national popular vote. This compact would not take effect until states with 270 electoral votes joined in. But for our purposes right now, what's notable is that nine states have joined in on this, nine states plus D.C., and they are all states that had Democratic state governments. Mm. There has not been a lot of Republican interest. Now, if we were to get a split of the type that we're talking about, where Governor Romney wins the popular vote but loses the Electoral College, then I think there might be more Republican interest in doing this, since it would seem pretty clear based on the last 12 years that there isn't a systematic partisan advantage to the Electoral College or to not having it.
Mm. Aaron Blake, let me put this question to you finally. About 30 seconds left. Forgive the fact that we don't have that much time. But what would a split vote mean for the legitimacy of the presidency? Is that a factor you're thinking about?
Yeah, it's definitely, especially with the looming fiscal cliff situation that we're all focused on and will be focused on. The question of how much political capital the president has matters a lot because people are upset with the amount of things that government's getting done. And so I think that in the case where it's that close and there's kind of a disagreement between the Electoral College and the popular vote, that could lead to a scenario where the president isn't seen as having the same kind of political capital as he otherwise might have. Mm.
It's Aaron Blake, political blogger with The Fix at The Washington Post. Aaron, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Alexander Kasar, professor of history and social policy at Harvard University. Professor, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.